Studio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for Q1 at 20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today we're speaking to Jim DiEugenio from Los Angeles. Hello, Jim.
How you doing, Len?
I've been better. I don't feel that great today, but, you know, January, flu season.
The show must go on.
Yeah, right. And speaking of that, you're right in the middle of the fires, from what I understand. Actually, in between them? Is that right?
Well, on the east side, the west side, and just recently on the north side. We had the ones in Altadena, which is due north of Pasadena, and that's Pasadena is about three towns east of me, actually more like two. Okay, then we had the ones out in Ventura County, and that's to the west of me, and those were threatening to jump the 405 freeway, okay, but they didn't. All right, and now there's one up in Santa Clarita, which is about 30 miles north of me. The closest one, though, was in Sylmar, but they managed to get rid of that one pretty quick. I actually used to live there. It's about 10 miles north of where I am right now. And this has become a political football. You know, leave it to Trump to try and make something political out of this in order to deny climate change. You know, it hasn't rained in any substantial degree in Southern California in 9 months. All right, there's been like 1/10 of an inch of rain. Now, from what I hear, it's going to start raining this weekend, which would be terrific, okay? You know, but it hasn't rained in 9 months, all right? And, you know, in order to deny climate change, you know, they want to blame it on somebody else, okay? But I think the climate change has a lot to do with it. You know, when I first came to California back in the last millennium, there was a rainy season. It rained from about February to April, okay? And I'm talking, it really, really rained hard sometimes. Sometimes you couldn't even get out of your car. There was so much water coming over the curb, all right? But as time has gone on, you know, the rain has all but disappeared, all right? You know, so I don't know how to explain that in any rational way. You know, except by, you know, climate change, all right? And so that's what's encouraged these fires, I believe. So anyway, I'm still alive. My sisters have called me, you know, they're emailing me. They told me to get out of here, et cetera. But, you know, I'm going to stick it out. And if I catch on fire, well, so be it. I'll let you know, Len.
Okay. All right. Okay, then. What is new on the JFK research front?
Well, there's actually a couple of things. You know, there's we're all waiting for Donald Trump to do what he said he was going to do, which was release the files. Now, on the Kennedy's and King website, we actually have a link to a little speech he did in which he said not only is he going to release the JFK files, he's going to release the King and Robert Kennedy files. And we actually have this on video for the people who want to see it. It's in the news section of Kennedy's and King. You know, so not enough people read the news section. But anyway, we have the video of that. Jeff Meek alerted me to this. So You know, I don't know if Trump is for real here. I don't think he understands all the resistance he's going to get. I think he overstated it. You know, I think he should have done it this way. I think he should have released all the JFK files first, because that's one where he has a mandate from the review board, you know. And then once those were all declassified, then I think he should have switched, you know, to the King case and the Robert Kennedy case. But I think he overplayed it. I don't think he realizes just how powerful the resistance is going to be, you know, to release. I mean, you're talking a lot of paper. There's a finite amount in the JFK case. The estimates I've seen is 3,800 documents, okay? But nobody even knows how many there are in the King case, or the RFK case, since there's never been an ARB in those two.
Well, I hope he does, and we need somebody to kick things up. And
well, yeah, I don't care who it is. You know, I'll take Trump or anybody. But when he announced that, by the way, as you'll see on the video, he got a cheer from the crowd when he said that. Now, also, there's an Arizona congressman, and we have that story in the news section of Kennedy's and King also, who is a guy named Schwickert, who is trying to pass legislation that will go ahead and declassify the last of the JFK files. It's called the Justice for Kennedy Act. Now, he actually went on Fox News to talk about this. All right, let me quote, "Freedom of information is more important than vanity. The only way we can have a functioning republic is if we have access to information. And sometimes that includes the potentially uncomfortable truth. And that's why I introduced the Justice for Kennedy Act, requiring all assassination records be unclassified and unredacted. The moment we begin to treat our country like adults is when they will start to trust American institutions once again." Now, that's a really, really important statement that he just made there. Okay. And this gets to the heart of the whole problem, which I've talked about a long time. All right. We will not get the trust back in the American government until all the truth is out about those three major assassinations of the 60s, right? So he hit the nail right on the proverbial head right there. All right, this is an issue that the mainstream media wants to completely avoid. Now, Andrew Eiler, an attorney from up in your neck of the woods, okay, Hamilton, Ontario, all right, has done some really, really important work on this, and he's preparing a very important article, two versions of it, a short one that he's going to try and get published in a major venue, and then a longer version for Kennedy's and King. And the information that Andrew uncovered is very, very, very important. Because if he's correct on this, and he's been talking to people like Jeremy Gunn, you know, the former chief counsel of the ARB, then we shouldn't have to go through all this. All right. This should not have been delayed by Trump the first time. And it should not have been set up to give the FBI and CIA a venue to argue, like Biden did, all right? And so I'm going to let Andrew talk about this. Once he publishes his article, he'll be on your show to talk about this issue. You know, this has been, in the worst sense of the word, a complete charade, and the National Archives has been a part of this charade, all right, ever since the 2017 termination date, right? Okay, it's legally, if the information Andrew uncovered is correct, and I think it is, it's legally indefensible what the National Archives has done. All right, and Andrew went to the archives. All right, I think he was aided by Paul Blow, who met him down there. And he got some very good evidence that he's correct on this. This is really kind of sickening. Okay, I don't want to talk about it. I'll throw up. Okay, so let's go to, as you know, on Kennedys and King, we don't just have the news, although the news is always interesting. All right. But we also have very good research articles. All right. And there's two of them that are up there. You talked to Mark Adamczyk, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That was a good article about, you know, the influence of Rogan and Napolitano. And, you know, I have to give those guys a lot of credit. You know, really. I have to, because they kept the pressure on Trump. You know, Napolitano is a pretty big podcast show, and Joe Rogan's one of the biggest that there is. I mean, he regularly gets between 5 and 10 million views on the Joe Rogan Experience. All right, and they've kept the pressure on Trump. I give them all the credit in the world for this. And I believe that's the reason that Trump is going to have to do what he's going to have to do, however reluctant, you know, he feels about it. All right. Now, there's also a nice short article we have by John Kellen. His book, which I hope you're familiar with, Praise from a Future Generation, that book, if you're not aware of it, you should be aware of it. And if you haven't read it, you should read it. Do you know about it, Len?
Yeah, I had him on to talk about it when he
published
it.
Oh, okay, great. See, what this is, what his book, Praise from a Future Generation, is, it's the best history of the early birth and growth of the critical community that I've ever read, okay? It takes it from 1964 with Mark Lane. Actually, I think, didn't Mark Lane publish his article in 63? I think he published actually that in December of 1963, okay, in The Guardian. And then Salandria did a beautiful article in 1964. I think it was for the Philadelphia Legal Intelligencer. And he traced it. He traced the development of the critical community from those two pieces, you know, all the way to 1966, 1967. And the publication of things like Epstein's Inquest, Sylvia Marr's Accessories After the Fact, and Tink Thompson's 6 Seconds in Dallas, and Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment. Okay, he traced it up to the beginning of the Jim Garrison investigation. And it's an incredibly valuable book. There's a great exchange in that book between Salandria and Epstein. If you recall, Epstein's book was actually the first critical book that really had an impact, and that was in 1966. It was called Inquest, all right? Epstein was supposed to be at a debate in Boston in that year, and he was supposed to be part of Salandria's team. He didn't show up to sit at the table, but he did show up in the audience. And at a break in the proceedings, Salandria talked to Epstein. He said, "Ed, what are you doing here?" He goes, I wanted to watch." And he goes, "Wait, you were supposed to be here at this table with me." And Epstein said, "I've changed, Vince." And Salandria said, "You made a deal." And Epstein didn't say anything. He said, "All right." Vince said words to the effect, "All right, but don't you ever present yourself as a critic on this subject again. All right." And so the book is like that. It has all these. See, what happened, I believe, if I remember this correctly, is that Vince Salandria, a few years before he passed away, had all of these boxes of correspondence. Back in those days, we didn't have email, so he actually had to write letters, you know. And he kept all this correspondence that he had, you know, with people like Sylvia Marr and people like Tink Thompson, etc., and people like Ray Marcus, And John said they were literally boxes, which he physically transported from Vince's house, which was in Philadelphia. And I think John lives in Denver. Okay. And so he then decided, after going through all this, he said, you know, there's a book here. And boy, was he ever right. I mean, that is a wonderful, wonderful volume. And I really can't recommend it enough if you haven't read it. But anyway, he wrote an article for us, a short article, about the passing of Harold Feldman's wife, Emmy. She was 97 years old, and she passed away about a month ago. Now, Emmy's real name was Irma. If you don't know who Harold Feldman was, he's a prominent figure in John's book because he was the brother-in-law to Vince Salandria. And in the early days, Harold actually got published in The Nation. He wrote a couple of very important articles in The Nation. One, I think, was about, was Oswald an FBI agent? And the other one was about the number of witnesses who heard shots from the grassy knoll. All right. And so now let me set the stage for this, because this is something that is really, really something, really amazing. Vince and Harold and Emmy actually went to Dallas before the Warren Report was issued. All right? Let me say that again. Those three, Vince and Harold and Emmy, went to Dallas before the Warren Report was issued. That means in the summer of 1964. All right? That's absolutely stunning. All right? And they were urged to do this by Mark Lane, who was just starting up his critical community called Citizens Committee of Inquiry. All right? And so that journey had a lot of historical value to it. And just to name a couple of reasons. Number one was their interview with Margaret Oswald. Emmy was very impressed by Margaret Oswald and her belief in her son's innocence. And then, of course, was the encounter. You really couldn't call it an interview with Helen Markham. And they were told that Helen had decided not to talk to them. She did talk to them on one occasion for a little bit, but then when they returned, she wouldn't come out her door. And I think it was her son who answered the door and said she couldn't talk to them anymore. And they suspected it was the Dallas police. And the son more or less admitted that. All right. So from that trio of that historical journey, Emmy was the last survivor. And John penned a very nice salute to her and a commemoration, you know, for the work that those three did. Between what Harold Feldman did on the number of witnesses who hit, who heard something from the grassy knoll, and Vincent Salandria's work on the single bullet theory, you know, that was those two blasts against the official story were simply decimating, you know, and you can't really give those early critics enough credit, in my belief. You know, a lot of people criticized Vince because, first of all, he was so loyal to Garrison, all right, and Secondly, because after about 1968, Vince decided that there really wasn't any point in arguing the forensics of this case anymore. You know, it was simply too one-sided. The Warren Commission was full of crap, right? And he tried to concentrate more on the big picture. And a lot of people didn't like that, but I think he was really correct, you know. And he really, his early articles and Harold's early articles, those really forged a path that other people could follow, you know. And this included many, many people. You know, once this information was out there, you know, was Oswald an FBI agent? You know, number two, how could 53 witnesses from the grassy knoll be all wrong? Thirdly, how is it possible for that single bullet theory to have done what it did and left CE-399 pretty much intact? You know, see, those were like bulldozers, you know, that paved the way for other people to follow down that trail, you know, that the Warren Commission was a farce. So I'm really glad he wrote this article about Emmy, and I'm really glad, you know, that in this way it commemorates, you know, what those three people did on that very early trip to Dallas. I mean, the more you think of it, can you imagine going to Dallas even before the Warren Commission report was out? You know, I mean, that's really saying something. You know, Vincent Salandria smelled a rat, you know, from the very beginning, you know, and he never really let go of the tail of that rat. You know, his brother, Harold, kind of stopped writing on the subject after 67, 68, you know, because he just didn't see, you know, even by then you could see, you know, when CBS broadcast that horrendous, you know, four-night salute to the Warren Commission, which Roger Feinman, who used to work for CBS, exposed, and which I wrote from his notes about. You know, what a setup job that was. You know, I think it was pretty much the writing was on the wall. And if you remember correctly, that right around when CBS broadcast that four-night special, NBC did their hatchet job on Jim Garrison. You know, the Walter Sheridan thing. You know, so a lot of people began to see, and I think Harold was one of them, was the establishment was going to go to the brink on this issue. You know, there was going to be, you know, there was going to be no debate about this. They were going to do everything they could to back up, you know, the seven clowns on the Warren Commission. You know, and there was going to be no fair treatment for the critics. I mean, just take a look what they did to Jim Garrison. I mean, that was unbelievable, you know, what NBC was allowed to do there. You know, so Harold decided to more or less retire from the field, okay, about 67, 68, you know, and Vince Salandria went on, but he went on in a more macroscopic. See, rather, you know, Vince was one of the first people to actually make a speech about Kennedy and Vietnam, you know, which is really something to have done that in the late 60s, you know. And when Vince died, I described, I don't know if you remember this, in my memoriam to Vince, Arlen Specter, of course, is from Philadelphia. which is where Vince lived. All right. And Spector decided to do a talk. I think it was at some library in Philadelphia. Vince was the first guy there. And he was sitting there very quietly. You know, nobody suspected who he was or what he had done, you know, or what he was on to. And he waited very patiently for Spector to get done with his speech. And then when Spector decided to take questions, Vince stood up and he went right at him. He goes, "Do you really expect the American public to believe that whole thing you made up about Commission Exhibit 399? And I'm not exaggerating that much. Okay, that's pretty much what Vince said, you know? And he just laid in the Specter, right? You know? Because that early in 1964, you know, Szilagyi and Feldman realized that this was just a pile of baloney, that something was being covered up, that this hierarchy on the Warren Commission was really a joke, you know, and that these lawyers, you know, the attorneys that were really doing the day-to-day work, the senior counsel and junior counsel, that they were simply flacks for a decree that had already been decided very early from above. You know, and so Szilagyi just laid in this, and Spector really never got over that, okay, that pasting that Szilagyi gave him, you know, live, you know. And then, of course, we all know that Gayton Fonzi lived in Philadelphia at that time, and he became friends with Szilagyi, and he wrote for Greater Philadelphia Magazine, and he decided that Szilagyi had made a lot of good points. And so he visited Arlen Specter. And that's how you got the famous tapes, the audio tapes of Fonzie talking to Specter and Specter stumbling all over himself trying to explain this single bullet theory. All right. And Fonzie, at that time, was kind of in the middle, all right? But he said, after I visited Szilagyi and Vince told me the questions to ask Spector, I was stunned at how inept Spector's replies were, because everybody knew that Spector was a very effective district attorney. You know, he'd gone to Yale Law School. He'd been in the Philadelphia DA's office a long time. Rose the first assistant, okay, at this time. And he really knew how to handle himself when he was questioned. He said, I was just stunned at how halting, you know, and how confused his replies were to my questions. And this turned Fonzie, of course. That encounter with Spector turned Fonzie around on that case. And then he decided to join up with the church committee in 1975. And in his wonderful book, The Last Investigation, he talks about how he talked about this with Vincent Szilagyi. And Szilagyi tried to advise him not to do it. You know, he said, look, Gayton, they're going to have you running around in circles. Okay. They're not going to take this case. Well, Vince was both right and a little bit wrong on that, because the church committee actually wasn't that bad. You know, if I had to pick one official committee from the federal government that actually did a fairly decent job, you know, the competition isn't too tough, okay, because you had, you know, the Warren Commission, the Rockefeller Commission, and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. You know, those were the other three investigations. You know, the Church Committee actually, you know, with Gary Hart and Richard Schweiker, they actually did try and take on the case, you know, although they were not allowed to actually go into the forensics of the JFK case because it was beyond the scope of the Church Committee, you know. But they, some of the things that Schweiker has said before he passed on, and Gary Hart, of course, is still with us, you know, some of the things he said, you know, were really some very interesting comments from people who were senators. Okay. So Vince was both a little bit right. You know, he was, Gayton should have never joined the House Select Committee. That was a mistake by him. But in his defense, when he joined up with the House Select Committee, Richard Sprague, the attorney from Philadelphia, was the first chief counsel, with Bob Tannenbaum out of New York City, his deputy. So if you take a look at his book, he thought, and he was correct on this, that this was really going to be a real investigation of the JFK case. But of course, that was not to pass because the media was not going to accept a real no-holds-barred inquiry, and that's the kind of lawyer that Sprague was. And Vince understood this because he knew Sprague from being in Philadelphia, all right? And by the way, you know Tannenbaum has a book coming out?
No, I didn't know it's coming out right now.
It's coming out in about 3 months, okay? It's scheduled to be released in April, and he changed the title on it. Okay, I really don't know what the title of it is now. But that, you know, I'm looking forward to that because a lot of people have tried to convince Tannenbaum, okay, to, you know, why the heck don't you write a book? You know, you had a ringside seat at this stuff, all right? And so he finally went ahead and wrote a book on this, and it's coming out in about 3 months. So that should be pretty interesting. So anyway, Fonzie stayed on even after Sprague had to leave, even after Tannenbaum had to leave, or he decided to stay on. And in his book, he talks about how disappointed he was when, you know, Blakey and Cornwell took over. All right. And of course, in that respect, Vince was correct. But anyway, John wrote a very nice salute to those very important early pioneers, you know, and the last of them, Emmy, okay? Very interesting. Now, Gary Aguilar wrote a two-part article about Robert Wagner's new book. I think it's called JFK Assassinated, you know? And Paul Hoke warned Wagner about writing this book because he said, look, you're going to be a punching bag for Gary Aguilar. And, well, I think that's pretty much what happened. You know, and Gary's always quite, you know, incisive and quite honest. And so he did a two-part article on Wagner's new book. And then we have John Washburn from England, who has done what is going to be a three-part article on Tippit, on the death of J.D. Tippit. You know, and, you know, when he gets done, which he's not done yet, you know, I think you should have him on, because I think he brought up some very interesting stuff in regards to the Tippit case, you know, which we've written about this before, but his uses more primary sources than I think anybody has ever done on the Tippit case before. And he tries to center on people like Jerry Hill and Westbrook, okay, as being involved in this case. You know, which I think you make a pretty good argument for that being true. All right, so when he gets done, which I think is going to be fairly soon, all right, I think you should actually have him on. All right.
Very good. Him and Tannenbaum too, yeah.
Well, I don't know if Bob is going to do any publicity for his book. Okay, we'll see. All right, but you can bet I'm going to review it, so that's the next best thing. Now let's get to some correspondence, which we never run out of. All right, let's go to a guy named Monty Franks. All right. Just a question. How is it no one has made the leap that the other attempts on JFK may have been dry runs to test the whole Dallas plot for leaks? Things like Miltier, etc. Then the Secret Service dumps their files. Bolden gets framed, etc. It all kinds of looked like it was done as a James Angleton-style test. Leak it, see who talks, close up behind them. Your thoughts would be appreciated. Thanks for all your work. Well, you know, there has been a debate about this. Was the Chicago plot a real attempt to kill Kennedy? Or was it a test run, you know, to iron out any kinks in advance and to see if the Secret Service would stay quiet? All right. And there's some people who believe that that was the case, that the Chicago plot was really a test run in advance. I've argued the other thing, that I believe the Chicago plot was really an attempt to kill JFK. All right. But I can understand other people, you know, taking the other point of view. All right. If it was a dry run, then it was very successful, I believe, because they did perfect it a few weeks later, you know, in Dallas, you know. So Monty is, that's a very good point, you know, and I think it's debatable. I don't think anybody can come to a finite conclusion on that. I happen to think it was for real, but I've seen other people argue the contrary. So I'm glad he asked that question, says, since it should be out there. All right. Eddie, he calls himself EJK. All right. Happy New Year's, gents. Hope all is well with you both. This one is for Len. You know it's coming, don't you, Len? Would love your take on this whenever you can fit it in. On Trump's announcement of his desire to annex Canada and today's resignation of the window mannequin Justin Trudeau. Thank you. Well, Len, that's obviously for you. All right.
Well, it's just another humorous anecdote from, you know, Trump, like he's talking about taking over Greenland. And, you know, it just...
Well, wait a minute. He didn't stop there. He also said the canal zone. Okay. You know. And then he said he's going to has his eyes on Canada. You know, he's going to get into this tariff war with Canada. Okay. And he was talking about manifest destiny, you know.
Well, Canada's been talking about fighting back with their own tariffs.
So yeah, that's true. That's
correct. Turn off water and electricity and things like that, right? Or up at 25%. You know, just I don't think he'll be prepared for that. But, you know, it's almost it's humorous to me. I don't take it seriously.
You know how much oil the United States imports from Canada? I mean, a lot.
and Mexico.
Right. Well, he's already sending the military down to Mexico, down to the border. Okay. He's always plans on sending 1,500 troops down to the border, you know. Yeah, I'm not so sure you can do that in peacetime, but he's going to try, you know. And then he's trying to negate the 14th Amendment. Even if you're born in the United States, you're not a citizen if your parents weren't. Okay, and the 14th Amendment, that's completely contrary to that. Anybody who's born or naturalized in the United States, you know, is a citizen of the United States. Okay, it was done because of the Civil War, you know. But, you know, who knows with the court system we have today, you know. Well, what did you think of Justin Trudeau? That's the other part of the question.
Hated him. You know, when he first came in, I didn't mind him. He did a few things that was very refreshing. He said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and he did them. But then after he was freezing people's bank accounts and called the truckers rally, you know, Nazis, and then all that stuff, just all that stuff. Then they had a real Nazi in Parliament, and everybody stood up and gave him a standing ovation. I don't know if you heard
about
that.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. What
a crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the beginning of the end for Justin Trudeau?
Well, yeah. Maybe just the midway point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can you freeze people's bank accounts when you just donate $50 or $100 to a cause?
You know? Yeah, I know. That was pretty bad. That was really bad, I thought. Who's going to be the next guy?
There's a Pierre Poilievre. There's a guy named Mark Carney.
Mark Carney?
Yeah. He used to be the finance minister for Canada. Then he moved to England for a while. And he did a pretty good job, but, I mean, it's so wrecked. It's like, and, you know, even with Trump getting in, some people are just so rabid about Trump. If he does anything good, like, for instance, let's just say he releases the JFK files and he does a couple of things. People will still be mad at him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. There is something to this Trump derangement syndrome. Okay. You know, I have to say that there is a point in that, you know. Anything the guy does, there's the MSM, you know, is kind of rabid about, you know. And, you know, and by the way, let me explain why I think that is. If you recall, when Trump was running against Hillary Clinton, nobody gave him a shot in the dark to defeat Hillary Clinton. You know, all these big Hollywood celebrities, you know, like George Clooney, etc., they were basically laughing at him. You know, they said words of the effect that, you know, Donald Trump has as much chance of being president as I do, you know. And the mainstream media felt the same way also. So
and
then
they said, we're going to leave the country if he wins. You know,
well,
some
people actually have done that. But
really?
What I'm saying is nobody expected him to win that election. You know, they were shocked. And if you remember on YouTube, once Trump won the election, his fans put up these videos because they collected this stuff. Of all these people saying, no way in the world that guy, you know, and it got him, there was like an 8-minute one I saw, you know. All right, and they were essentially shoving it in the mainstream and Hollywood's face. All right, and I believe that's the reason that this Trump derangement syndrome began, because they didn't like being proved that they were wrong. You know, they didn't have the pulse on America. You know, Michael Moore was one of the very few people who predicted that Trump was going to win. You know, he said, you watch what's going to happen. You know, when all those people in the Midwest and Mideast, you know, get their chance to go in there, they're going to essentially raise their middle finger to Hillary Clinton. because she like represented, you know, the political establishment. All right. You know, and so that's where I think this all started. And I actually talked to Bob Peary about this once before he passed away. You know, see, everybody thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win. You know, everybody who was anybody, they didn't take Trump seriously. And so they were determined then to like prove that they were right and he was wrong. All right. And so this is how I think this all started. At least that's, you know, that's my two cents. Okay. Might be right, might be wrong.
All right.
So
one
just
of the things you can't
Justin
win,
Trudeau
right? You
was
win.
Out, and you think, what's this guy's name again?
Who? The guy from Montreal?
Yeah, the guy you think is going to be the next.
No, I thought you meant EJK. Pierre Poilievre or Mark Carney.
Mark Carney. Okay. Yeah. All right. So when is that going to happen?
No date yet.
Oh, there's no date on the election?
No. But, of course, it's small potatoes, I mean, with the American election just last week, right? And once again, people can't believe they were wrong, you know, and to the degree. I mean, I've had a few, you know, fights where, like, with, you know, friend Vince Palamara or Chris Milligan, you know, and they just hate him. They just hate him. And I go, you know what I'd like to talk about? I'd like to talk about how can Biden pardon so many people? How can he pardon Fauci? How can you know? And then they just go, Trump, 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 Trump. And I go, I'm not talking about Trump. I'm talking about Biden here. But you can't. The sickness is deep.
You know, when I was really surprised, he how can you pardon a doctor? You know,
well, there's many posters that say, don't you have to be charged with something or do something wrong to be pardoned?
At least an indictment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. You know, and he's pardoning Fauci when I don't think anybody was ever talking about even indicting Fauci, you know.
And that makes me think, well, what could Trump and Robert Kennedy Jr. dig up on him then? You know, and they know. Which is even worse, right? So I'm not sticking up for Trump, you know, and he's, you know, says he's going to take over Canada and do this and all this. Like, okay, yada, 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 whatever. So I'm not sticking up for him, but I'm complaining about the other side, that when you run somebody like Kamala, and they kept saying Biden was okay, he's the best he's ever been and all that, and then you find out he's almost senile, you know, if you can't run anybody, then that's what you get.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Kennedy Jr. had to change sides, right?
Well, you know, that whole thing was, I wrote about this on my Substack, you know, and I did a two-part article on this, you know, and I thought this was really a joke, you know. I mean, Pelosi, we're supposed to believe that during that debate with Trump, that was the first time that Pelosi ever noticed that, you know, Biden might not be 100% in control of it. We're supposed to believe that, okay? That and nobody else was aware of it, you know.
And the other thing is, doesn't she? I'm not sure the exact number, but didn't she make like 250,000 a year? And then she's worth like 15, 20 million.
Yeah, or more. Right. She's a millionaire.
Right. Yeah. And then her husband and they. It's really crooked.
So then we're supposed to believe that she didn't know any of this until that debate. And then everybody started fearing that they were going to have no chance to win the House back. Okay. Which, by the way, they didn't anyway, you know. And then Biden was forced to abdicate, but he said, I'm not closing the door unless I pick my own candidate. And so he sticks us with Harris. And from my understanding, Pelosi didn't expect that. She thought there would be some kind of open process and other people would get to run. So here we have this failed candidate who had run for president twice, you know, and it didn't work out very well. Now she's nominated by Biden, you know, and the same result, the same thing happened. So in other words, I guess Biden was giving the finger to everybody who forced him out.
Oh, it's a great moment When somewhere in the campaign, he put on a Trump hat. He put on a MAGA hat, and people took, you know, I just laughed. I go, oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is what we were stuck with, you know. Like Bloomberg said, this is Mike Bloomberg, you know, the billionaire from New York. He said, this is no way to run an election. That was no way to run an election. And again, like Hillary Clinton, Harris had the big monetary advantage. She had like 50% more money, you know, than Trump managed to raise. Now, of course, there's always Elon Musk, okay? There's always the Musk factor. You know, Musk first said that he wasn't going to donate any money to Trump. He ended up spending like $140 million, you know, to get Trump elected. And by the way, I liked the front row at his inauguration speech, didn't you? You know, Bezos, Musk, and Zuckerberg.
Yeah, well, to tell you the truth, yeah, I didn't really, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, the same old billionaires are there.
So anyway, that's the kind of setup we're going to have. Like the, you know, I've always wondered why nobody asked this question. You know, do these guys really need a lot of help? I mean, really, when you have a few billion, isn't that enough? Okay, you know, but these guys have hundreds of billions. You know, do they really need the help from the White House? I never could figure that out, or why nobody asked that question. You know, but Bernie Sanders, if you haven't seen it, he made a nice reply to Trump's speech, okay? And he said it's not so much what Trump said. It's what he didn't say that bothers me. You know, and he went into this whole thing about nobody can afford a house anymore. You know, and isn't it time we had tuition-free colleges? You know, and this kind of stuff. And he says, you know, and Trump didn't talk about any of that, you know. But I think it tells us something that the DNC vetoed Bernie Sanders, and then he makes a speech like that. You know, at least he's still on the scene. All right, let's go to our last question here. This is from Barbara S., you know, one of our most loyal followers, and she's very smart and very incisive, you know, and I'm glad we have people like her. All right. This was about 2 weeks ago. I was listening to a Harrison Salisbury talk at the UCLA archives. So one of the two comments got my attention. Salisbury said he was preaching about the Vietnam War. Now, that seems strange to me because this man had been making trips to Vietnam. To me, he wasn't prescient, but simply informed on the conditions there. Then further on, Salisbury says in his talk, we didn't commit genocide in Vietnam. That got me thinking, were our actions in Vietnam genocide? All right. In fact, there's an article in the New York Times in December of 2017, which was titled That Question. Did America commit war crimes in Vietnam? All right. And this was based upon a verdict reached by International War Crimes Tribunal, known as the Bertrand Russell Tribunal, after the philosopher. It was chaired by Jean-Paul Sartre and 23 internationally recognized academics, lawyers, scientists, former heads of state, and peace activists. Two separate sessions were held, where evidence brought before the panels from their trips to Vietnam were judged. They found the U.S. guilty on all charges, including genocide and the use of forbidden weapons, mistreatment and killing of prisoners, and violence and movement of prisoners. The tribunal was not a government or treaty organization. It had no legal authority to carry out a judgment. Its mission was to inform the world of the impact on the peoples of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. My question is, was this talk by Salisbury in January of 68 a response to December 1st, 1967 verdict of that tribunal? Or was it just another of those pesky coincidences? What exactly was Salisbury's role as far as covering for our government? And although we missed the anniversary of the tribunal, it is a topic for discussion. After all, we're talking about, according to Mark Lane, a man who could read 26 volumes of the Warren Commission hearings and exhibits in 3 hours. You know, I have to say, first of all, I remember the tribunal. I remember that because John Paul Sartre, you know, one of the great intellectuals of his time, was a part of that. Okay, so I remember that tribunal. I didn't know about Salisbury's talk at UCLA, but it does seem to me that Salisbury was probably responding to that. You know, look, remember, this is Salisbury's talk was in 68. The Vietnam War still had 7 years to run at that point. When it was all over, there were well over 5 million people dead, you know, including civilians. And by the way, I'm including Cambodia in that because I don't think you cannot include Cambodia in that. Nixon invaded the country, all right, and Johnson bombed the country, all right, and Nixon actually dropped more bombs in Indochina than Johnson did. So you had, over the estimates I've seen, over 5 million people dead, you know, as a combination of those two Indochina wars.
Yeah, for what?
Yeah, well, that's the big question everybody wants to know. It was the most senseless, devastating war, you know, which I don't think America ever really got over, you know. I mean, it was actually a monument to stupidity, you know, when you think about it, you know. She has a follow-up here. Let me later in the Q&A, Salisbury says he's only visited North Vietnam. He has no knowledge of South Vietnam. Now, how does that make him an expert on Vietnam War policy? This, you know, that's a terrific question because, as everybody knows, the war was fought in the South. I mean, we bombed the North, but the war was fought in the South, you know, almost all of it. All right, and the reason it was fought in the South is because America, McNamara, you know, was very fearful that if we invaded North Vietnam, the same thing would happen as what happened with Korea. The Chinese would pour over the border. All right, and it would all be over because there was no way the United States was going to beat the combination of North Vietnam and China, you know. All right, unless we decided to go ahead and step up the war and start including atomic weapons, you know, and nobody in their right mind, except maybe Nixon, believed that Vietnam was worth using atomic weapons, you know. Oh, by the way, did I ever talk about that? Yeah, during the Easter Offensive, which I believe was either 71 or 72, when Giap made an all-out gamble to take Saigon, and things were really at an emergency level. Nixon, although he always denied this, once the tapes were declassified, at the same meeting, Nixon wanted to use both atomic weapons and to bomb the dikes. Okay. Kissinger, if you can believe it, Kissinger is the guy who had to talk him down off the ceiling, you know, and he said words of the effect, if you bomb the dikes, that will kill 200,000 people. All right. And by the way, and when I talked about this with John Newman, he said, no, Jim, if he would have bombed the dikes, it would have killed 500,000 people. In other words, it would have been the single worst wartime atrocity, in the history of warfare, killing 500,000 innocent people, All right. And then he suggested using atomic weapons. And Kissinger just got up. When he said that, Kissinger just got up and walked out. Okay. When I read this, I said, do you know how bad Nixon has to be if Henry Kissinger is walking out on him? And so that is how bad this Vietnam War got. That is how bad this thing was. It was really one of the most horrific. In post-war American history, the only thing that comes close is the invasion of Iraq. And I think I actually think Vietnam was worse. Although I agree that it's pretty tough to choose between which disaster was worse. But if you take a look at all the things we did in Vietnam, all the civilians that were killed, Operation Phoenix, Agent Orange, the decimation of villages, the My Lai massacre, all that incessant bombing of the North. I don't know how you don't call those war crimes. And I agree with her that Salisbury was probably replying to that Bertrand Russell thing, because Jean Paul Sartre was really, a world celebrity by this time, based upon his writings, not just in philosophy, but also, his novels and his plays. He was a first rank intellectual. There really isn't anybody like him today, because he had that much stature worldwide. So that did attract some attention. You really wonder looking back, at how things got so out of control and how all those students were right. All those students who got sprayed, with gas, with water hoses, who got clubbed to death at all those demonstrations, who were placed in jail, they were right. They were right, and everybody else was wrong. Everybody in the media, because, until the Tet Offensive, which was in 69, until the Tet Offensive, the media was pretty much behind the Vietnam War. It wasn't until the Tet Offensive that Walter Cronkite went on the air and he said, we should not be fighting a war we cannot win. And this has proven that we cannot win. So isn't it time to really reconsider? And Johnson, more or less, when that happened, he threw in the towel and he said, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost America. My question is, what took him so long to figure that out? This is in 69. The Tet Offensive was in 69. Was it in January, I think? It was January, right? January of 69. And so that's one of the things that convinced Johnson that this was all, we have to find a way out of this. And then he sent Clark Clifford over to the Pentagon, oh, excuse me, I'm wrong. I'm wrong, Len. You let me run off the mouth. Okay, it was 68.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the Tet Offensive was January of 68.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. And so then he sent Clark Clifford, who was a new Secretary of Defense, he sent him over to the Pentagon. And Clifford said, I spent 2 weeks over there And I asked these guys, you know, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force. I had all those guys there. And I wanted to know, what's your plan on winning this war? And after 2 weeks, I figured out they didn't have one. You know, because I kept on asking them questions. I said, how do you cut off the flow of the North Vietnamese? You know, if we give you more troops, what if they bring in more troops? And they didn't have any answers for those kinds of questions. So at the end of 2 weeks, he says, I went back to Johnson and I told him, Mr. President, I think it's time to give up on this. Okay. I don't think there's any way we can win the war. At least these guys don't have a plan to win the war. It's a real loser, you know. And so that's when, you know, Johnson decided it was time to get out. And then, of course, we had that idiot Nixon, you know, who said, I have a plan to win the war, you know, which he really didn't, you know. In fact, he admitted during the campaign to two of his speechwriters that there really wasn't any way to win the war. Because Nixon had heard about Clifford's conference, okay, and he had also heard about Dean Acheson walking out of a meeting with Johnson, okay. I think I've said, told that, but that's a very interesting story. During the Tet Offensive, you know, Johnson called in all these guys, you know, like McCloy and Acheson, and you know, and all these former secretaries of state and defense, and he had them there. And he was trying to tell them that we didn't really lose a Tet. That was really a defeat for Hanoi. And he brought in this Pentagon guy to read a speech about this. And Acheson got up and walked out. Now, if somebody as hawkish as Acheson, you know, walks out on the defense of Vietnam, then that should tell you something. And so Johnson calls up Acheson and he says, Dean, why did you walk out? And Acheson said words of the effect, Lyndon, I'm not going to listen to any more canned speeches anymore. All right? I'm just not going to suffer through that. I want to see the raw reports. All right? Because that's the only thing I can render you an opinion on. I know what these guys at the Pentagon are going to say. With them, they're always winning, no matter what. I want to see the actual data that it's based upon. I'm just not going to listen to these, more of these. And so Johnson actually did allow him to look at, and Acheson agreed with Clifford. All right. So Nixon comes in with his so-called secret plan to end the war, which he really didn't have one. It was really Vietnamization, and everybody knew. I mean,
well, I think the catchphrase was peace with honor.
Oh my God, right. Please don't make me sick, okay?
Okay, all you right. Know? Okay, we can wrap it up then.
Peace with honor. Oh God, what a joke that was, you know? And so everybody knew that if you turned over the war to Saigon, there was no chance that they were going to win. I've talked to some of these guys who were in the field, you know, and they knew if we turn this over to this Army of South Vietnam, I mean, the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong will run these guys over in a couple of months. Okay. So it's just a matter of this whole thing, peace with honor. And Nixon's great speech about the silent majority. And then the other thing was that if America looks like a trembling giant, okay, in the face of this third world country, you know, well, and everybody, even Richard Helms, said that this was wrong, you know, that there would be no great drop of prestige by the United States if we had an orderly retreat from Vietnam. Okay, and so what happens? Like all these guys predicted, once the United States got out, you know, Hanoi ran over South Vietnam in, what was it, like 4 months or something like that? You know, because okay, let's admit it, there was no government of South Vietnam. South Vietnam was an extension of the United States. And once the United States got out, you know, that was going to be it. It was a monumental misjudgment that Kennedy understood was a monumental misjudgment. There was no reason, there was no rationale to put American prestige and blood and treasure, you know, on this peninsula of Vietnam. It made absolutely no sense in so many ways because, first of all, as Kennedy understood, you know, how do you use American firepower in a guerrilla war? What advantage does the overwhelming firepower that the American Army and Marines have, what does that do if you're fighting in a guerrilla theater where you don't even know who your enemy really is? And who, by day, are telling you how friendly you are as Americans, and by night they're taking in the Viet Cong. Okay? How do you win a war like that? And by the way, to show you how prescient Kennedy was, and I'm sure you know this, he was asking those questions in 1961. He was asking those questions in 1961. Okay.
Yeah, that's why he was pulling out. That's why he was withdrawing.
Right. See, when he couldn't get a straight answer to those questions, okay, that he said, look, we're getting out of here. Okay. All right. And he was correct. All right. So anyway, thank you so much for that, Barbara. You know, she always sends me very interesting stuff. She sent me another thing, which about this guy in England who I tried to do some research on, you know, but he was saying that somehow he understood that this was a plot and he had gone into the American embassy, you know, and I had actually never heard of this guy, all right? You know, and so I had to look him up, and I can't fully deal with this particular question because I really, after looking it up and doing some research, his name was Sir Javesky. All right. So if anybody else wants to try and do some work on him, Sergievsky. All right. And so after doing a little bit of work on this guy, I couldn't come to any definite conclusion about him, you know, if he was for real or if he was just, you know, blundering, smoking mirrors, or if he was a little nutty. So I don't want to deal with that in any kind of systematic way. But if anybody else wants to look him up and if anybody else has an opinion on this, you know, I'll be glad to reopen it. All right. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, Len.
All right.
We covered the waterfront again.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Have a good night, partner.
Okay. Good night.
Bye-bye.